same time, oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, we never lost sight, I would say, of simplification of the procedures. And I think in not, and that was our mission, and not losing sight of that really served us very well. And even though we were perhaps didn't meet all the classical chemistry, it was a pretty good way to run a plant.
We always kept all of our procedures for every test in a handbook. So this was almost, and then the procedures then got to be...
with icons.
Yeah, icons and pictures, and this was updated. This was updated constantly, and...
Clifford had another expression, you can run a Hawk test if you can read.
Yeah.
Well, now I've got to the place you could run a Hawk test if you weren't blind.
Actually, this also, you could also almost do this if you can't speak English, because the picture is almost carried.
Yeah, okay, that's right.
So
it became universal.
A Latin-based language, you can almost do it without speaking English.
When did the first edition of this come out?
Oh, that goes back, different editions go back into the...
80s.
Was that in, I thought maybe the 70s.
Well, I don't think so. Bruce. I would say the early 80s.
But when you bought
that's 20 years ago.
That's right, but when you bought a DREL, if it had 40 tests, all 40 instructions came with the product.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, our early catalogs was the procedure and then the price down at the bottom for the reagent. So... in the early catalogs were procedures. That was one of our marketing techniques.
Coupled to that, would you go and visit some customers and teach them how to use equipment, or was it really just
a lot of that becomes, the intent is it becomes so self-explanatory you could do it on your own.
Right.
And that was the thought. We'll mail you the product and you could do it on your own just because it's right. But actually, we did get into our own
Hawk little... Technical Center. Talk about
our own little training center called HTTC, and people would actually come out for 2 and 3 day seminars where they would go through it step by step, procedure by procedure, and a lot of customers really liked that.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that at essentially our expense. They paid their own transportation, but then we charged almost no... tuition fee.
And we furnished all the food and all the training. But they
thousands of people went through that. So they'd be drinking water managers, wastewater managers. But we did have some for chemistry teachers. We had a chemistry teacher section. And I've forgotten the total number of thousands who went through that. So we were trying to hit it on two tiers. One, you should be able to do it yourself. But the little training center was available too. But the beauty of that was if both of those techniques had a tendency to contribute to institutionalizing the test and your standard operating procedures. And we did find ourselves getting written into the standard operating procedures of a drinking water plant. It'll say, take Hawk chlorine test kit out and measure this filter every 4 hours.
Yeah.
Hard to lose at that point.
Actually, Danaher closed down the Hawk Technical Training Center, and they started it back up.
Yeah, there's too much demand.
They found out, we didn't do everything wrong.
Sticking in the 70s, just for another brief moment here, part of what happens as a result of EPA regulations is that industry comes under more regulation, especially
right.
in terms of pollution control and effluent.
Right.
Do you begin to sell products to the Dow and DuPonts of the world for them to do effluent control? And if so, that's a very different market than the municipal water company.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. However, some of it is highly specialized that we don't make every... We're in the water conditioning business and so forth. But we did manufacture COD tests. We obviously offered the classic BOD, but then carbon, oxygen demand, and TOC. Mm-hmm. And we had major market share. We had major market share in those products. And that was another significant invention, to be able to pre-manufacture the reagent and then take it, put in the sample, and digest it for 2 hours, and then go straight to a pre-calibrated DREL test. And then they know, from that point on, they actually then structure their treatment system based upon the oxygen demand or the amount of organic material in the waste.
Actually,
so we did pretty well with that.
DuPont used to advertise that the water they took in, their effluent into the Brandywine is better than what they take in.
Yeah.
And of course, in a lot of industry. But now, I do want to say one thing here, and I've already touched on it once, but I want to reemphasize that in the industrial end, we serve every single manufacturer of water treatment chemicals. And therefore, we didn't get into each one of the individual plants, but the Betts salesman did, or the Nalco salesman did, or the ChemTreat salesman did, or the Olin treatment salesman did. And then we got into a very unusual situation. We knew, and everybody was very quiet about it, we knew what every chemical treatment manufacturer was doing.
Yes.
And we knew who was biggest, and because there was no one else that was making. Mm-hmm. But, and we had that business was 100% Hawk.
Yes. And that became some special formulation. There are a lot of treatment chemistries for like corrosion inhibitors and so forth.
That matched their treatment.
So then we would actually then formulate a colorimetric test for that. And then that offered mm-hmm. the assurances that everything was working properly.
Actually, there was another thing that, now I remember the Nalco gave us their formulas. And now they said, now we want you to manufacture for us. And then our guy said, gee whiz, we can improve on these a whole lot. Because, well, you know, that they didn't.
Yeah.
They weren't specialists in that, mm-hmm. you know, and we
mm-hmm.
were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk, if you would, Kitty, about the coming to Loveland and why that was and so on.
Okay. Well, all right. In 1970, the microprocessing our instruments were getting old-fashioned, and it was obvious that we had to get up to date, and we needed to get electrical engineers that were microprocessor current or fluent, and we couldn't get them to come to Utah. These guys were all, where were they? Well, they were in Silicon Valley, they were out on Route 124, or they were down around Texas Instruments in Dallas, and you say Ames, Iowa to those guys. And we actually hired a search firm to try and find us some electrical engineers. We paid them, and they turned us, and they tried, and they said, you are the toughest client we have ever had, because you can't get anybody to come out to Iowa. And it became obvious that I think all electrical engineers that came out of Iowa State, they left the state. You know, Iowa State at one time did not realize that 92% of all the engineers that they trained left the state. The 8% were the agricultural guys that went over to John Deere. And okay, it was obvious that we weren't going to get this pulled off there. And along in this period here, I bought the FBO operation at Fort Collins Loveland, and with a young man, which was a financial failure because he, for a number of reasons. But we were coming out here and looking at this FBO, and boy, we realized, hey, wait a minute, this is a pretty nice place. And Hewlett Packard is here, IBM is here, Western Electric is here, National Cash Register is here.
HP has four plants, just mm-hmm. written, and they employ about 10,000 people in those four plants.
This is the place to come.
And in the 1970s, Hewlett-Packard and Texas Instrument were probably the role models mm-hmm. in electronics manufacturing. then with that is a massive infrastructure of circuit board makers and etched and drill board makers and integrated circuit makers, and none of that existed in Iowa.
Yeah, that's right. So we came out here and we bought that first 10 acres of ground again and at the airport. And that's where the plant is today.
And that was a plant to do the microprocessor and the...
Well, we're going to move instrumentation out here, and of course from hiring out here was no problem at all.
But then we kept Ames. Ames still makes all the chemical
chemistry, and then all the instrumentation is done here, and then R&D came here, mm-hmm.
And corporate headquarters moved here.
And corporate headquarters moved here.
When was that?
77.
And listen to how old-fashioned this is by today's standards. We did this, and with the intended goal, the stated goal, that we would offer anybody in Iowa a job out here if you wanted to come, and a job back there if you wanted to stay. And they said we would try to make it a corporate goal that no one loses their job against their will. No way. And in today's world, that would be laughed at. But it became kind of a noble cause. And I think in the very end, Ames ended up with about 2 extra people. About 100 families moved out here and so forth. So just the opposite of shutting something down and firing everybody. So it worked pretty well.
Yeah.
Worked pretty well.
That was. And then the people that moved out here, at that time, they got a great deal because housing was lower priced here, so they could sell in Iowa and come out here and buy a bigger house, and whee, you know, so they were happy. And of course, and it's a nice place to live here. And
Colorado actually has a lot of electronics and a lot of, I think it was ranked like 7 or 8 in the country as far as electronics technology. This is a good area.
So would you do it again? And the answer is absolutely.
Yeah.
Only maybe even earlier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you could begin to see that, we've already just, Iowa is agriculture, and there may be a resurgence of the Midwest, that there is some talk now of things that are turning around. But, you know, at the same time, you sort of have to live life as it's going right now.
Yes.
So, it made a big difference to the company. We took a bump in earnings at that time, but we came back very quickly. Mm. And of course, we were public at the time, so we knew that bump.
Yes. Yes.
But we never had a year that we didn't have a profitable year, even with the move. We had a dip, but we still had profits.
Oh yeah, in the very, yeah, we were still doing 15% pre-tax profits. I think Danaher's up there is taking a little higher, but we'd have been 15% pre-tax profits and 8 or 9% after-tax profits. So we're making money.
Pretty good.
Shall we take a pause? Because I think we're at a sort of point of inflection in the stuff. Okay. Kitty, can we actually pick up with the aeroplane for a moment? because it features in the company in some way, and we left you several years ago with falling in love with airplanes at the age of 6, but
all right. Well, from that beginning, I just loved airplanes and always wanted to learn to fly, and finally we reached a point in 1953 that we had enough money that I could start taking flying lessons. And Cliff said, go do it, get it out of your system. And so I did, and I got a license in 1954, and we bought a little airplane, and we started using it in some business flying. And we flew to call on some customers. We even tried to go to American Water Works convention, but the weather was too much and we had to stop in Huntington, West Virginia. But that is a long way of saying we have had airplanes involved with the company, though the company didn't buy them. We owned the airplanes, and so that we were never had a problem with the IRS. And so we always had an airplane from 1954 forward. Then at the time of the move to Colorado, I had a Cessna 310, and they started using that quite extensively. And then I guess maybe I've forgotten now the details, but I sold it to the company, and then the company traded it in on a larger twin, Cessna twin. And then from then on, we just started moving up then in through King Airs, and then finally at the very end, then we had citations. And then I got a citation rating, and I had a citation, which then we used in the company. So we did about 600 hours a year flying, because we went back and forth between the Ames plant and the Loveland plant on an average of twice a week, because we really thought this was very important in keeping these plants together. And we had two pilots. We never had an accident. We never had any difficulty at all. We ran an absolutely flawless operation. We had a mechanic. We had we had very, very little downtime. I know that there were some times when the air was kind of rough, but no one was ever, people had great confidence. And then, in fact, they could go with Costa and Jim. That's the way they didn't want to go on the airlines, because it was so, all we had to do was walk across the street and get in the airplane.
So when you're saying you did 600, who did the 600 hours in a year?
The company did about 400 hours, and I did about 200 hours.
Yes. And were you going to and fro, would you and Clifford be together all the time, most of the time, or what? How did all?
I don't like to answer that, because I know how you're going to be feeling. Cliff and I flew together all the time.
Yes.
And actually, I'm going to tell you, he was sitting back, and I would fly the airplane, and then maybe he'd come up at the time of the approach, and sit down with me. But Cliff got a license. He got up to 80 hours, but he said, "This isn't for me, and I don't care about it, and you can just go on." So I was the luckiest girl in the world when it comes to flying, because generally it's a fight over who gets the left seat, and we had no problems at all. I got the left seat. and Cliff didn't care. But he liked to go. He liked to fly.
So we
did a lot of it.
So this continued over the years, going to Ames and going to meetings and customers. And
I have 7,000 hours.
Mm-hmm. Are you're still flying?
Yes. But I probably, my flying days, I have some macular degeneration, especially at the left eye. And so I think that I'm not going to be able to continue to pass my physical. Otherwise, really, I'm in pretty good shape. I don't know. 7,000 hours. I'm not.
No rookie.
I'm not. Oh, I'm not worried anymore.
What would Clifford be doing on the flight, typically?
Paperwork, or writing up notes, paperwork, that kind. He always had things with him. We had, especially in the Citation and in the King Air. Well, I had two C-90 King Airs, and the company had three B-200s. And then it had two Citations, and I had one Citation. I've had a total of 23 airplanes. My present husband says that I have helped the used market greatly in airplanes. In the back section, there would be two what they call club seating, one this way and one this way, and then there were little tables that came out, and Cliff would pull off the little table and it would work. Mm-hmm. He'd sit in the back. Mm-hmm. That was it. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of flying that way. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun.
It's pretty neat. Coming back into the corporation, we got a little into the sequences that led up to the merger. I guess I want to go to Bruce for a minute and say, you came into the company in this sort of human resources.
Yeah.
Territory. Is that where you stayed, or did you move around the company? What happened over the...
I stayed in that till 1988, and I became president in 1988. So I was COO from 88 on, I guess. And Clifford died in 1990. So,
yes.
So I was the operations person, I guess.
And now, Bruce may be too modest to say this, but I would like to say about Bruce, he became deeply involved in quality control.
Yeah.
He became our quality control guru.
Yeah. I had a period of time for a couple of years where I guess during the 70s and 80s, in which the Deming principles were so well accepted in Japan, and Japan became so advanced in manufacturing technique and also reliability.
Mm-hmm.
I started to really study that, and because of that, our products are relatively, a lot of these are relatively niche products, low volume. I just didn't think we had the inherent reliability that we really should. And so I kind of got behind this business of process control and variation management and the statistics. But it turns out it's not a bad management tool, too. So it's quality, but it's really, a lot of it deals with systems integration. And the Hawk personality seemed to like it. It seemed to fit in well with our inherent culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I really got behind that, and I really into all kinds of charting and graphing and comparisons and lead times and vendor, the whole nine yards. And
I really enjoyed that. Bruce, with his position by this time as president of the company and COO, and with his love of the quality control, and of course, and then what was available to him, Hawk became a leader in quality control in this entire area. Even you know, Hewlett Packard was so big and so cumbersome, but little old Hawk really got out there, and we supported the organization of the what was that organization called, Bruce, that everybody belonged to, where all the QC people belonged?
You don't mean actually, ISO?
No.
No, we did. We did get our ISO rating. So, mm-hmm. And then we did rally around ISO for about two or three years. That took us from original position to full ISO certification. And that was another... There was really kind of two areas. One was ISO for consistency of process. But then the other quality issues was the absolute verification of output.
And we had two or three women in the plant that, like Patty Lamford, who really got into this. And all these QC people had meetings. And I think we had, my point is, we had an influence on everybody in the quality control.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Bruce was very strong in the leadership of this.
But the much of American industry was going through a quality movement at that time. Mm-hmm. Motorola, we were really following a lot of Motorola's Six Sigma program. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So we weren't the only ones. But it was a good role for me, as a. But it worked well.
Let me ask you a slightly provocative question on that point. One could argue that a company that's been very innovative and has been very quick to take products from research to market, if you add layers of quality control and process, some of your employees are going to feel stymied.
Yeah.
How did you work around that?
Well, the classic answer is that it's all in an ideal world. In a Deming-driven world, a lot of the processes would be administered by the person themselves, and not you're trying to actually get away from inspection, and you're trying to get away from a third party coming to analyze. You're really trying to encourage everybody to do the measurement themselves.
Self-inspection.
And so the better your system, the more it's actually self-generated, self-measured. And then you actually then teach each employee the mathematics to take their measurements to a higher and higher level. So in an ultimate world, you actually take layers away and you take inspection away. In fact, you know, I got so ingrained in this, I'm having a hard time with Homeland Security. That's exactly what we're trying to get away from, is people sitting around who could make no value added. That was the whole idea. Everybody who does something is actually contributing to the improved essence of productivity. And a QC inspector with his calipers measuring really isn't contributing anything. But easier said than done.
Mm-hmm.
We still had layers of management that... But ideally, we try to strip them away and not add them on.
So in terms of innovation, it didn't cause a problem. I mean, there weren't people who said,
I think the area that could be would be there's the one thing that's inescapable, and our quality isn't perfect either, but the one thing that's inescapable, the more the volume, the better the systems work. And the less the volume, the more you really kind of constantly compromise. And we did have some awfully low volume products. Mm-hmm. So you can't do a control chart if you're going to build two a month, you know. But I think we had a good sense of trying to be reasonable, but you're right. But we tried to do everything. That was the goal. Everything you do would add value or add sustenance, and we tried to strip out things that ultimately don't make a contribution. So, but it helped the company. It was a good rallying point. And then we tried to publish defect rates and measure defect rates from month to month and if anything really and try to make even make problems visible. I've forgotten all these words. You raise the visibility level.
Uh-huh.
Make sure that everybody can see what potentially could go wrong and has a chance to actually fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Hey, I do have one other thing that I want to add, though, that because as we run, we do have one other product family that we didn't talk about. If the DREL comes along in 1955, we also had process instruments that would take a sample measurement at a point in the and do a test. And I think these go back into the 1950s.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
The very early...
These were capillary gravity...
The capillary units.
Capillary gravity feed instruments where there would be... So if you were measuring chlorine, some early stage of a drinking water plant, they'd take a sample, since the water is always flowing through. Drinking water plant is like a river flowing through it. They would take a sample at a different point and then give a measurement at that particular point. You could see how this could easily be integrated into a control panel.
Right.
But these were some of the very early process instruments. There weren't many people, and gosh, Clifford wanted to do these things for very low prices. Mm-hmm. I think this chlorine analyzer, which I think goes back to the late 50s, gosh, it was only $300 or $400,
wasn't
it?
Yeah, I think this started out $295. It was early days. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, and so then we also did this to turbidity, and we almost became really the almost the world standard.
Hey, Bruce, excuse me. Let me add one thing before you go on.
Hold on.